Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, a healthy dose of historical drama, one mixed with music and an exhibit at the Presidio, another with a touch of comedy, and a further one delving into quantum physics. Caroline Clark, who is director of Sarah Rule's funny and insightful comedy In the Next Room, or the Vibrator play, opens the 16th season at the Pear Theater in Mountain View. She'll be here to talk about that work. From TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, we meet actors Carrie Kawa and Robert Gilbert, who star in the regional premiere of Constellations, directed by Robert Kelly. They play the theoretical physicist Marianne and the charming beekeeper Roland, who meet and fall in love in the multiverse. Also be talking with Matthew Oshida of the Farallon Quintet, which performs on September 15th at the Presidio Officers Club, and with Lisa Petrie of the Presidio Trust. The concert relates to the ongoing exhibition Exclusion, the Presidio's role in World War II Japanese-American incarceration. Plus, regular contributor and roving critic at large, Peter Robinson, gives an overview of activities at Bay Area's bookstores in the week that Amazon opened its first brick-and-mortar store in San Jose, and he has some words on poetry today. Stay with us. Well, starting off with the exhibit at the Presidio, and by way of background, I'm going to quote from a friend of mine's book, Greg Robinson, who wrote the book A Tragedy of Democracy, Japanese Confinement in North America. As a refresher course, here we go. In the spring of 1942, a few months after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor launched World War II in the Pacific, the United States Army, acting under authority granted by President Roosevelt and confirmed by Congress, summarily rounded up the entire ethnic Japanese population living on the nation's Pacific coast. These American citizens and longtime residents, some 112,000 men, women, and children, were packed into military holding centers for several weeks or months, then transported under armed guard to the interior of the country. There they were confined in a network of hastily built camps constructed and operated by a new federal agency, the War Relocation Authority, or WRA. Although some of these inmates were able after a time to leave the camps and resettle outside the West Coast, most remained in captivity for the duration of the war. This official action, commonly called the internment of Japanese Americans, but more accurately termed their confinement, has often been referred to as the worst civil rights violation by the federal government during the 20th century. Not only were things confined to American activities, but also in Canada, people were relocated and forcibly removed from Canada. And even in the Latin American world, Japanese in North America have been suffering through this action. Following agreements between the U.S. State Department and the governments of Peru and other Latin American nations, the United States forces carried off some 2,300 ethnic Japanese, plus larger numbers of ethnic Germans, from their home countries, brought them to the United States, and imprisoned them in an internment camp operated by the Justice Department at Crystal City, Texas. The Mexican government, though it refused to surrender any of its residents to the United States, decreed mass removal of ethnic Japanese from its Pacific coast in 1942 and confiscated their property. That's just part of the introduction of A Tragedy of Democracy, Japanese Confinement in North America by Greg Robinson, his second book on the subject. He's quite a scholar on it. And it is in this context that the Presidio Trust opened an exhibition earlier this year as part of the Presidio Sessions, Exclusion, the Presidio's role in World War II Japanese-American incarceration. Many people don't realize that the Presidio did play a pivotal role in the incarceration of those 120,000 or so Japanese Americans. And I'm joined by two of the people that are involved in the project, Lisa Petrie, media relations specialist for the Presidio Trust, and violinist Matthew Oshida of the Farallon Quintet, which will perform a special work inspired by Mine Okubo's graphic novel of her internment experience called Citizen 13660. LA-based composer Chad Cannon wrote the quintet Citizen 13660 in 2014, and it will be performed by the Farallon at the exhibit on September 15th. A very warm welcome to Lisa Petry and to Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
So nice to have you. Lisa, perhaps we can start with what the exhibit is going to be focusing on and the Presidio's role in this massive, really human tragedy when it comes down to it.
Well, David, I think you really touched on it when you said that the Presidio, the General DeWitt at the Presidio, was the one who signed the civilian orders to execute these executive orders. And so in the Bay School, what is now the Bay School, he sat at his desk and signed those orders and carried out the incarceration is the word we're calling it, incarceration, because many of them were actually American citizens, and they were sent away without due process. And so this kind of chapter is part of an ongoing special exhibition at the Presidio Officers Club, and it's meant to just to have a platform for the dialogue about these themes of racial profiling and immigration and failures of leadership. So that has been an ongoing exhibition, and now what we're doing here with the new fall programming of the Presidio Sessions, of which Matthew and Farallon Quintet is a part, we're from time to time finding some touch points that relate to this exhibition, but by no means is the whole fall session season about the exhibition. But we're hoping that people will be engaged in it through new perspectives, new art that we're bringing, new performing arts groups that we're bringing, which I could tell you a little bit about later. But I'm very curious about the piece that Matthew and the group will be performing, because it relates directly to a woman who was interned in camps.
Indeed. Matthew Oshita, you also have a very personal connection to this whole affair, as your grandparents, your uncles,
great grandparents as well,
were interned.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we started the Farallon Quintet about 5 years ago, and one of our missions has been to commission composers, living composers, to write works for us. And we got in contact with this composer and out of LA, Chad Cannon, who you mentioned, and he. But thanks to a grant that we received through the Barlow Endowment for Music Composition at Brigham Young University, we got the funding for him to write us a piece, and he actually chose the topic himself, which was about the Japanese relocation camps. He actually has a degree from Harvard in Japanese studies and a composition degree from Juilliard as well. But so he likes to merge those two here and write music that has significance to the communities and such. So he just, by coincidence, told me that that was the topic of his piece, and I started to, obviously there's a personal connection to me, having heard stories from my relatives, my grandparents, all of them, about their personal experiences, and that piece, as it evolved and, got to learn more about it and actually work on, learning it for the first time, a lot of those stories that I heard became alive to me and really took off.
Could you share with us some of those stories that you heard? Now, as a kid, were you like, oh, Grandma, I don't want to hear this story again?
Yeah.
Were you more like, now that you're a little older, maybe you have a better appreciation of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't really obviously understand the significance of the stories, but I do remember my grandmother telling me things like, when she must have been around 20 years old or something, when this first happened and she received something in the mail that they needed to report somewhere, my relatives were from Watsonville area, and they needed to report in Arizona for one of the relocation camps in Poston, I believe, out in the desert. And I remember my grandmother never really traveling away from home, and it was the very first time that she had to do that, and she said she had to get on a train and go someplace she's never been, and she was alone for some reason. And I remember her saying at the train station she was just overwhelmed with everything and actually passed out and was just terrified. But, she woke up and someone had put a pillow under her head, and to her that was like showed some warmth. And at the time, I mean, she mentioned that they weren't allowed into restaurants in California during the time. There were signs that said no Japs allowed and things like this. So You know,
and this is in spite of them being, you know, American born
yeah.
Citizens. They were upstanding property owners and business owners. And it's extraordinary that this happened. And yet, it did not happen to the Italian Americans or the German Americans on the East Coast. And it seems such a racially profiled history repeating itself. Let's face the facts here. It's sad that it's really a tragedy of democracy.
Yes.
Well titled Greg Robinson book.
Yeah, my grandparents, my great grandparents immigrated, and then my grandparents were born here, and my grandparents really never even spoke Japanese, didn't really have any tie to the country, and most of them had never even visited. So, you know, this was kind of a surprising thing for everything.
So talk to us, if you can, a little bit about Mine Okubo.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've learned things and saw her book as a result of Chad's research on this. As we know, they couldn't really take photos at the time during those camps. So there really isn't too much documented from there. I know there are some that are around, but she drew a lot of what she saw and made kind of like cartoon pictures, if you will. And so Chad took those with titles and created these vignettes based on that. I know that I'm not so in-depth or scholar on her or this topic, but I believe she was in charge of like some art, something to do with in the community, and she was from the Bay Area in Berkeley and doing stuff here. So I know that what he did was take these titles and create vignettes, short vignettes, like just a minute or 3 minutes for each one. There's eight short movements, and each one captures some aspect of the camps. I mean, I can give a couple examples of them, like the first title is We Were Outnumbered, and that actually refers to all the rodents and the mice, the critters, the insects that were found in these camps. And, you know, he does a good job of capturing what that would have felt like. Multiple movements, which all tell a story. Everything is this rhetoric that comes alive as you listen to the piece of music. One is about the wind playing havoc with the fine dust particles. Like I mentioned, my relatives were in Arizona, and another story that I always heard was how they were in the desert. There were always dust storms, and it would be so hot, and dust would get in their nose, it would get in their ears, and they were constantly trying to clean that out. And this movement uses a lot of harmonics and all of these different octaves jumping up and down, signifying wind. The composer chose to use the pedal note D to represent dust, and that note is throughout the whole movement present. So a lot of this multiple movements that if you ever have a chance to look at all tells the story of this and the people that experienced it.
We'll hear that excerpt shortly, but let's hear a little bit more about the Fairlawn Quintet itself. When was it formed, and why a focus on clarinet music?
Yes, actually it was founded in 2012. It's been around for about 5 years. We actually just started as friends. One of our clarinet friends, Natalie Parker, had just won the job with San Francisco Ballet, so she had moved to the area, and we wanted to play together. So we just got some of our friends together, started reading through clarinet quintets. Most people are only familiar with Mozart and Brahms clarinet quintets, which are really the only ones that are played on regular series
today.
And
let's face it, gold standards.
They are phenomenal pieces of music.
Actually, the Mozart is one of my favorite, even as a flutist, it's one of my favorite works of all
great.
Time.
Great. We are actually going to play the Mozart for our Presidio sessions.
Okay, and that's going to be on September 15th, let's remind people, at the Presidio Officers Club. Is that right, Lisa?
Right, and it's a good idea to register for any of these free concerts, even though they are free, just to register at the link on our website at presidio.gov so that you don't have to be turned away.
We should make a little call out to, in addition to Natalie Parker, your quintet is also on violin, Dan Flanagan, my good friend Elizabeth Pryor on viola, and Jonah Kim, cellist.
Yes. As I was saying, it kind of, we didn't intend for it to become something fixed and to grow as it has. We were just playing chamber music, but we were basically saying, I wonder if there's anything else written for this repertoire. And so we started digging. We started, actually met with musicologists. We found a professor out of University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Don Ayler, who has done a ton of research in this area, making it kind of one of his life's missions. He's actually documented over 600 existing clarinet quintets, which no one has heard of. Most clarinet soloists, a lot of the professors have
and
never
maybe
heard
it's
of it.
Just as well. We don't know.
No, I mean, some of them, maybe there's a reason why they're not played, but a lot of them are, we consider, hidden gems.
Sure.
And we make it a point to play, you know, obviously we can't help ourselves from playing Mozart and Brahms because those are amazing pieces of literature, but we've found a lot of other ones that are beautiful in their own right and things that deserve to be played. And we've been programming that in addition to, as we did for this piece with Chad Cannon, commissioning new composers and bringing those to light as well.
Mm-hmm. So back to your aunts and uncles, grandparents, are they still with us? And have they seen this exhibit? Are they going to come see the exhibit? And have you seen the exhibit yet?
I haven't yet. I'm looking forward to doing that when we go to perform there. Unfortunately, my grandparents have passed away, so I didn't have the chance to speak with them once this piece was written. Some of my aunts and uncles have, we actually recorded the piece, so I have given them copies of those CDs, which are for sale as well. Mm-hmm. But again, most of what my experience is from the stories that I was told as a child and then having those come alive as I was working on this piece.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew, it's possible you will find their names etched in glass at the exhibition.
Oh, wow.
There are the names of all 120,000 Japanese Americans that were that were sent away etched in glass at the at the exhibition. So it's quite powerful to see all of that.
Yeah,
and they're organized by camps, so you can look them up. And
oh, great.
It's Lisa Petri, the media relations specialist for the Presidio Trust and involved in the Presidio Officer Club events and programs, as well as the exhibit now through March of next year, I believe, at the Presidio. Where exactly is the exhibit?
All of these things are in the Presidio Officers Club.
In the club itself, okay.
Yes, which is 50 Moraga. And as a matter of fact, the whole series itself of the Presidio Sessions, which is the free series on Friday evenings at 7, it kicks off next Friday with jazz pianist Larry Vukovic. And it does feature a lot of a variety of music. So we're hearing from the Fairlawn Quintet, but also jazz musicians Miguelito Martinez and John Calloway, Delphi Trio, a Russian evening. So it's quite varied, and there's something for everyone.
Nice. Presidio.gov for more information. And I do want to give another little plug to my good friend Dr. Greg Robinson up in Montreal. Greg is an associate professor of history at UQAM, University of Quebec at Montreal, and also author of By Order of the President, FDR and the Internment of Japanese Americans. I mentioned his book that's currently out as well, A Tragedy of Democracy, Japanese Confinement in North America. And finally, he was a editor and contributor to Mine Okubo, Following Her Own Road, that includes some of Mine's incredible artwork and recalls Greg's personal encounters with Mine when they were both in New York before she passed away. Matthew Oshida, Lisa Petri, thanks so much for sharing this incredible exhibit and the music we're about to hear of Chad Cannon. We'll hope to catch that performance on the 15th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I should mention that Chad Cannon, wonderful commissioner of this, I guess he's the commissionee. He's the guy that wrote the piece. is L.A.-based. He's a composer and orchestrator whose style fuses elements of American and Asian, as well as popular and classical, cinematic and concert-oriented music. His music has been heard by millions worldwide in TV and radio broadcasts, films, and in live concert settings. In 2016, he was named a Sundance Film Music Composing Fellow for the Documentary Labs held at Skywalker Ranch. And he's been involved in orchestrating films such as Peter Jackson's The Hobbit Trilogy, as well as Gareth Edwards' Godzilla. So we will hear now an excerpt from Citizen 13660, based on the writings and artistry of Mine Okubo. This particular movement, The Wind Was Playing Havoc with the Fine Dust Particles, to be performed by the Fairlawn Quintet in concert on September 15th at the Presidio. music of Chad Cannon from Citizen 13660, based on the life of an internment camp member, and to be performed as part of the Presidio Trust's exhibit, Exclusion, the Presidio's Role in World War II Japanese-American Incarceration. The concert will be on September 15th. The exhibit runs through next March. The Farallon Quintet is Natalie Parker, clarinet, Dan Flanagan and Matthew Oshita, violins, Elizabeth Pryor, viola, and Jonah Kim, cello. Information about those concerts at presidio.gov. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulip, and you're listening to Open Air on listener-supported KALW San Francisco. Still to come, Peter Robinson will give an overview of some activities at Bay Area bookstores and some words on poetry. Also hear about Sarah Rule's funny and insightful comedy In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play, which opens the 16th season at the Pear Theater in Mountain View shortly. Caroline Clark will be in to talk about that. Well, and next, well, TheaterWorks Silicon Valley is going to continue its 17-18 season with the regional premiere of the London and Broadway hit Constellations. It's an unconventional drama which explores the infinite possibilities of boy meets girl with intelligence, heart, and humor as it follows a charming beekeeper and a Cambridge cosmologist's nerds in love, for better and for worse, both of whom join me in studio. Playing the quick-witted and fiercely intelligent quantum physicist Marianne is Carrie Kawa. She returns to TheaterWorks, where she was last seen as Viola in Twelfth Night and as Kitty Verdun in Charlie's Aunt. Carrie has also performed with Center Rep Company, Idaho Shakespeare Festival, the Great Lakes Theater Festival, among others. And Robert Gilbert will be making his TheaterWorks debut with Constellations as the laid-back and earthy beekeeper Roland. He's performed in theaters such as the National Theater, Complicité, Royal Shakespeare Theater, and Delacorte Theater in New York. Carrie, Robert, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Happy to have you. Well, this is some pretty heady stuff. I imagine, especially for Carrie, playing the intelligent quantum physicist, is this something that you have in your wheelhouse, so to speak? Do you have a quantum physics background?
I do not.
Now you do.
Stumbling towards genius. No, I mean, my connection to the character is from the heart. It's about, you know, what she's passionate about. It's her emotional connection to it more than her intellectual connection to it for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Robert, beekeeping experience in your background or not?
No.
Are any actual bees involved or harmed during this production?
No. We tried that during rehearsal, but we got expensive on Band-Aids and stuff, so we decided to cut the bees out. They're hard to control.
Any, I imagine there's some sound effects, though.
There are minimal sound effects. We started out with some more, but Carrie and I managed to ixnay some of the more extreme stuff by the time we got to production. But there are a few bees. So if you have any acute fears of bees, just know that they're not real.
I imagine that, yeah, be interesting, the 3D sound effects that we could confuse people in a theater setting. So let's talk about, let's drill down on the synopsis of the show then. It's a love story from multiple and simultaneous angles, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one way to describe it.
That's a pretty good way to describe it. It's not an easy play to describe in a sentence, but I think that kind of sums it up. It's the story of two people meeting each other and having a life together and having a relationship viewed from, I don't know, probably close to 100 different ways in different realities and different universes. The play doesn't ask you to understand exactly the format, but you become aware very quickly that you're getting to know these two people and seeing different aspects of their personalities, whether you want to see that as alternate universes, simultaneous universes. It's kind of up to you.
Mm-hmm. This had a run on Broadway as well. When did you first come across the play, each of you, just in this context, or had you seen a production before?
I remember hearing about it when it was on Broadway, and then I have some friends who work at a theater company in Boise, Idaho, who produced this play in their last season, so I actually got to see it there. So I had seen it once before. I auditioned for it for this company.
Yeah, I had known about it since it started in London at the Royal Court, and it made a big splash and then went on to the West End and obviously then the Broadway run, and it's been done several times since. So
haven't given a shout out yet to the playwright, Nick Payne.
Nick Payne.
So, and familiar with his work prior to this at all?
Yeah, I had heard of a few of his other shows and read some of his other work. He's a phenomenal writer, unreal, and so young. He's definitely one of those people that makes you feel like you haven't achieved as much as you should have. And he's the same age as you, and he's sort of, you know, yeah, getting all these plays on all these amazing.
I'm reminded of the anecdote that the great Tom Lehrer, comedian, pianist, also a physics teacher, once mentioned that, you know, it's people like this that make you realize how little you've accomplished.
Absolutely.
And his line was, it's a sobering fact, for instance, that when Mozart was my age, he'd been dead for 15 years. So I imagine Nick Payne also has a similar effect on once you learn about him. Do you know if it's based on a real character? Is it strictly Nick's interest in the subject?
I think it was based on an experience that he had with his dad when his father was passing away, and some, you know, conversations that he'd had with people about life and mortality. But I did order some for our opening night. I bought some of the guys some honey from London in keeping with the beekeeper theme. Uh-huh. And the people at the company told me that they thought that Nick had gone there to do some research when he first did the play.
Mm.
So apparently it might be based on a beekeeper from London called Dave. But, I mean, who knows if that's true. So
that's
Dave, if you're listening, Dave, you've made it all the way to California, mate.
And director Robert Kelly, who is also the founder and artistic director of Theater Works Silicon Valley, is the director of this play. What has he brought to the table that has maybe made you think about the work differently?
Kelly has a wonderful sensitivity to the way that his audience watches for humor and heart. And I think he brought a lot of those qualities to this play. It is described as a drama, but it also has a really warm heart and a lot of good laughs. So I think that he really, he brought that out of this play.
Mm-hmm. Any problem? Please, you're going to add something.
Right? Oh, no, I think that's absolutely true. I think that, you know, like Carrie was saying, it can be a daunting subject matter. And I think Kelly's done a good job of making sure that people don't feel stupid watching it. We sort of did that for them in the first couple of weeks of rehearsal.
Carrie, was it difficult wrapping your head around some of these concepts?
To be honest with you, I gave up at a certain point. I'm not going to be able to get the physics doctorate within the first couple of weeks of rehearsal. So I got a basic enough understanding to understand the words that I'm saying, and the concepts enough to buy into them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I understand why she's saying them, and I understand how she feels about the work that she does. She's someone who's very passionate about her work, and I can identify with that. So I run with the feeling.
I'm still trying to get my own head wrapped around the multiple aspects of this relationship and how it all works out in the end, but it's looked at from different angles and planes. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's very kaleidoscopic. It's almost like you're watching from the point of view of the multiverse itself. It's like you're looking at these people and their relationship through all of these different lenses of possibility. And they're all possible, and they're all sometimes contradicting each other. But taken in aggregate, once you look back on the whole play, you have a sense of these people, and you have a feeling of who they are and what they mean to each other, and it's very moving.
Yeah, I think it's a format that people have become familiar with over time, even starting with movies like Back to the Future and Groundhog Day, where you see these alternate possibilities of a situation that we're already familiar with. Mm. And then, you know, more recently you have movies like Interstellar and, you know, Inception, playing with the idea of how we perceive time and what we see. So really the play is about imagining one relationship in 1,000 different ways. You know, maybe because he woke up angry that morning, this conversation turned into an argument instead of a nice jovial dinner, which it does become in the second time you see it, because he had his cornflakes that morning or whatever, you know. So it sounds complex, but I think the format of the play allows people to get it pretty quickly.
That's Robert Gilbert playing Roland and Carrie Kawa playing Marianne in the TheaterWorks Silicon Valley production of Constellations, It runs through the 17th of this year, September 17th, theaterworks.org for more information about that show. And it's written by Nick Payne. Thank you so much for coming in today. We're going to go out with a little bit of The Soundscape by Cliff Carruthers from Constellations. Thanks, Carrie. Thanks.
Thank you
very much.
Some of the soundscape from Constellations by Nick Payne. Cliff Carruthers is the musician who created the soundscape for that. Constellations runs at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley through the 17th of September. Information at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. Let me get that website. TheaterWorks.org. That's theater with an R-E. TheaterWorks.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe with Open Air here on local public radio, KALW. Peter Robinson will be on shortly to offer us some poetry and some library offerings. And next, well, it should be an interesting segment. The Paratheater opens its 16th season on September 8th with Sarah Rule's funny and insightful play In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play. It's set at the dawn of the age of electricity. It's a comedy that explores how women's issues are addressed in a patriarchal society that rarely gives them credence or consideration. In the Next Room is directed by Caroline Clark, who joins me to talk about the play. Caroline is a lifelong thespian and a member of the Pair Steering Committee. Directing credits include several productions at the Pair. She's also been seen at the Empty Space in Bakersfield, California, at Los Altos Stage Company, and beyond that. She's joined now by the new artistic director of the theater, Betsy Cruz Craig. Betsy is an instructor for theater, speech, and debate, as well as an actress in her own right, appearing in several Pair productions, as well as with the Palo Alto Players, and she also recently directed the critically acclaimed Major Barbara at the Pair. Betsy, Caroline, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much, David.
Of course, nice to have you. And this is, it sounds like it's a historical, but it's based on historical fact that adding some comedic interludes or comedic introspection. Tell us first of all about the doctor that this is based on.
So Dr. Givings is the name of the doctor in the play, and he is treating women with his electrical vibration devices, and also some men, for what was known as hysteria, by giving them paroxysms. We now know that he was just giving them orgasms, and that is actually quite historically accurate
at
the
I've
time.
Heard about this, yeah.
Hysteria was treated in women, which really was probably just the feminine mystique or lack of personhood at that time. Or maybe just wearing a corset when it was 100 degrees outside. Who knows? But he's treating women for hysteria in the next room. But the play really centers very much in the living room or the parlor area where his wife, Catherine Givings, is. She's dealing with postpartum depression, and she's also having issues with lactation, both things that were not recognized or spoken of at the time. And they actually end up enlisting the help of a wet nurse in the show who is also... suffering the loss of her own child. So there's a lot of complexity happening in the living room and a lot of whimsical, silly now, but very serious at the time, orgasms. So the process has been pretty complex and interesting, but the rehearsals have been a lot of fun, and the script really has been opening up for us in ways that we didn't expect.
So part of what's going on, is, as I understand it, Caroline, is that there are patients being treated with this innovative therapy in one room while the doctor's wife is going through other things within going on at the same time, I want
to say. So she's actually in great need of treatment, counseling, therapy.
Does she get any from her husband, doctor, or not?
I won't ruin that.
I'm going to have to find out.
She's pretty much ignored in the living room. And like I said, it's very much the Betty Friedan feminist mystique that wasn't really even realized until about 100 years later. So she's just sitting alone, not able to feed her own child. And this other woman comes in, and her child latches right on, no problems, and it breaks her heart. And then all these new interesting people start to enter her life, and she hears them in the next room making very strange sounds and a very large, like, vibrating noise.
Having paroxysms.
Yes. Becomes very curious as to what's going on in that office, which before the show, the beginning of where we start in the play, she's never entered the office or really treated it with much regard.
And that's, for me, one of the things I really love about the script is you get to see someone who's trying to understand and explore their own sensuality, mm-hmm. because it's like a deserted island for her. She's never really explored that. And that was what surprised me in the script. It's like, oh, it's okay to be a sensual human being. I can do that. That's what happiness is. Mm-hmm. And there's things that she loves, like being outside and exercising and these things that connect her with her body. She has no connection to her sexual sensuality. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. It's a beautiful, beautiful story.
That's Betsy Cruz Craig, the artistic director of the pair. And director Caroline Clark, would you tell us a little bit about your cast then?
Oh, they're stellar, and I love all of them. playing Dr. Givings is Bradley Satterwhite. April Culver is playing Catherine Givings in the show, or Mrs. Givings. Sabrina...
Is that intentional, Miss Givings?
Yes. Givings? Also, we realized last night...
Ms. Givings.
I promise I'll get to the rest of the cast, but we just realized last night that as opposed to most traditional plays, Sarah Roll purposely calls most of the men in the show Doctor or Mister, whatever their last name is, and the women have first names. That is the opposite of most shows I've ever known. Shakespeare. Yeah.
Interesting.
So we thought that
intentionally.
This play is really just opening up for us over time. It's well
rich. It's a very rich piece.
So the rest of our cast is Sabrina Daldry is played by Ellen Dumfrey. Leo Irving is played by James. What is James's last name?
You're the director.
I don't have it in front of me. Lewis.
Let me see.
I know it. It's Lewis. I call
James
him.
Lewis, yes.
Then we have Damira Stovato playing Elizabeth, and Troy Johnson playing Mr. Daldry. I get their names wrong at rehearsal, so it's very hard for me to tell you who's who, because it's kind of like a mom with six kids, like, Catherine, Elizabeth. Did I name everybody?
Stephanie Crowley,
most importantly. Yeah, she's playing Annie, who is the doctor's assistant, and she is both hilarious and heartbreaking at the same time. She is a stellar actor. They are all local to the Bay Area, and I believe most of our cast members have full-time day jobs on top of being in this show. So
very common in the Bay Area with actors that we work with. Everybody has another life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt.
So, yeah, that's all of them.
A little back to Stephanie Crowley, who's the physician's assistant, who may be one of the characters that is the most separated from her sexuality and her sensuality, and yet she's performing this, you know, this procedure and getting people in touch with their own sense of physical connection, but she is separated from her own. It's very interesting.
Betsy Craig, you are just recently took the helm of Pear Theater.
I did.
This past August. So were you that much involved in this season, or are you more looking at seasons ahead and having your own stamp on them?
I was also on the steering committee along with Caroline, so I certainly was involved in discussions, but this next season is the one that we're currently working on developing, and it's probably the most exciting part my job thus far.
More exciting than paroxysms in the next room?
Unfortunately, I'm not in the cast. I'll have to work on that on my own time. But, you know, developing a season is really so complex and so interesting, thinking about balance and your audience and what kind of opportunities to offer local talent and is it relevant? Will it sell? Mm-hmm. All of those things you have to consider. It's an exciting time for us. One of our new taglines at the Pair is invite, unite, ignite. And for me, that idea comes from we want to invite the community into our theater. We want to invite you to escape. We want to unite and unite amongst each other with the thought that art now is more important than ever, that we have to recognize that.
We should, yeah.
And that it will ignite our passion to towards action, towards thought, towards conversation, perhaps towards argument. And to me, that is what the power of theater does. And so that's the season we're trying to come up with for 2018-19.
As an aside, you know, we won't mention him by name, but the president, you know, we're told doesn't drink. Imagine if he was if he started drinking and was given a vibrator.
There's a play there, David. Maybe we should, you know.
Something I don't want to see personally.
No, me, absolutely not.
It'd tousle his hair a little.
Maybe so.
Pair Theater's opening season In the Next Room with a Vibrator play by Sarah Rule opens on September 8th, runs through October 1st. Information at thepair.org. I wish you continued success with this season and beyond. Betsy Craig and Caroline Clark, fantastic production. I look forward to seeing the Vibrator play at the Pair. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much
for
having
us.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make two lovers of friends.
From Pal Joey, if you ask me, I could write a book and the great Frank Sinatra. An appropriate tune to introduce Peter Robinson and his segment on libraries, bookstores, and beyond. Hello again, Peter, and thank you. I forgot to mention, thank you for hosting last week. I got some wonderful comments from your hosting duties. Appreciate it.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here, and that is indeed Pal Joey. And this week, I'm going to be looking at Bay Area bookstores that I enjoy browsing in. And I bring that up because, to me, one of the true delights in any form of reading is browsing in a bookstore. And despite the online publications, which in many ways contributed to the loss of many Bay Area jewel-type bookstores, we still have a full range of choices. Now, I might add that this is the week that Amazon has actually opened its first brick-and-mortars bookstore in Santana Row in San Jose. But I should also add, to me, it's not an ideal browser's place. There's limited choices, mainly totally popular choices, and those are where you go. There's actually only 6 seats in the entire bookstore, so if you want to sit down and browse, that's not on the menu.
I think they're more encouraging you to purchase and leave.
That's right.
not a library.
At high speed, and there is no coffee, so you can't take the book, sit down, have a cup of coffee, and start reading. So my real preference for browsing is actually in second-hand bookstores, such as Green Apple on Clement Street. And I think one of the attractions is the range of choice, not only from the sharp jackets of the new, but some of the old second-hand books, which have often turned to be out of print So here's an opportunity to actually pick something up that you won't find necessarily in a new bookstore. I call them the great unsold. And I think bookstore browsing is not just for the eyes. I think it's also for the listening, the stories that you actually hear as you're standing in the stacks. I watched one guy come into Green Apple last week and in a very kind of arrogant, pushy voice says, "Have you got Trump on Trump?" And the guy said, "I don't think you would get that in one volume." And off we went into another little sector. And what I found in the sector beginning with G was Herb Gold, the old San Francisco writer and novelist Herb Gold. And I noticed him picking all his old books off the shelf and then looking inside them. And I was trying to find out what he was doing. Well, he was looking for readers' comments and how readers had responded to certain passages of the book. That, again, got me interested, because one of the great gifts of browsing is seeing how other people thought or felt about a particular book, read what they had to say. And Herb said to me, he said, "I'm just wanting to see how far they got into the story." So browsing, then, is a gentle sport, a gentle act, but the most delightful part of it is what I call that serendipitous moment. That is when you discover something that you weren't actually looking for. And a badly laid out bookstore can actually be quite a good place for a serendipitous moment, so you don't have to necessarily end up in the right section. In fact, you can be in the wrong section. And I'm going to say something about that a little later on, because that's how I came to discover the background to a poem by W.H. Auden. So here are a couple of choices, if you want to jot them down, of places where I find browsing is convenient across the Bay Area. If you want to go as far out as Petaluma, Copperfields in downtown Petaluma has both an upstairs and a downstairs section. Downstairs is the used books. It's quiet, easy to get to. As you come south from Petaluma, you're going to hit Marin County, and there we have Book Passage. And Book Passage is one of the great independent bookstores that virtually every author on a major tour wants to include. So they have events, they have readings, and they also have a newsletter. And it might be useful to get on the Book Passage newsletter list, because then you can see the calendar of things coming up. And just next door, in Corte Madera, is Barnes & Noble. And this is one of my favorite Barnes & Noble stores, because it's got about 90,000 books. It also has an ideal CD and DVD collection, and I think most important, it's one of those bookstores where the staff are extremely friendly. So if you say, "I can't remember the author, I know it's about this, I'm not sure of the title," they eventually will get you to the right place. And of course, they do have coffee. So you can get the book off the shelf, into your hands, sit down, have a cup of coffee.
A reminder that your local public library branch might also be able to do that, but you'd have to bring your coffee in.
Well, if they if they allow you.
Yeah, well, that's true too, yeah.
And then we're now back into the city again. Alexander Book Company, if you're working in the financial district, it's always good to have a bookstore where you can cross the road at lunchtime. And they have three stories. Downstairs is poetry, general affairs. The first floor you go into is the most popular choices. And then they have an excellent travel upstairs. So you've got a range of different things you'd like to choose. And, of course, no tour would be complete without putting your nose into city lights. In the basement, which people don't seem to know about, you can go all the way down.
Me included, but
yeah, the basement is worth a visit, and the top floor is much given to poetry. So you've got choices there. And then a range of books from Books Inc., who have book clubs tied to their many Bay Area bookstores. So there is what I call a relatively good range, despite this whole concept of internet book buying. Now, I kicked off by talking about browsing, and with browsing, I introduced the idea that the great gift of browsing are what I call serendipitous discoveries. And just recently I was preparing some talks on a British poet, W.H. Auden, and I wanted to find out about a particular poem that he'd written. The title is Tell Me the Truth About Love. And I know it was written in the late 1930s, but I wanted to discover, you know, to whom it had been originally directed. And fortuitously, lying on a table in dog-eared books, it was a book called Letters to a Friend. And I wasn't even looking at that. I picked it up, checked out the index. Auden was there. And it does turn out that this poem was dedicated to Christopher Isherwood, his longtime partner. And I can see the spontaneity of the subject, which is almost serendipitous. So here are just three verses from an excellent poem by W.H. Auden. It's called Tell Me the Truth About Love. Our history books refer to it in cryptic little notes. It's quite a common topic on transatlantic boats. I've found the subject mentioned in accounts of suicides and even seen it scribbled on the backs of railway guides. Does it howl like an angry Alsatian or boom like a military band? Could one give a first-rate imitation on a saw or a Steinway Grand? Is it singing at parties a riot? Does it only like classical stuff? Will it stop when you want to be quiet? Oh, tell me the truth about love. I looked inside the summer house. It wasn't ever there. I tried the Thames at Maidenhead and Brighton's bracing air. I don't know what the blackbird sang or what the tulip said, but it wasn't in the chicken run or underneath my bed. And he finishes, I think, with the critical verse, which tries to ply the answer and that element of surprise. Tell me the truth about love. When it comes, will it come without warning, just as I'm picking my nose? Will it knock on my door in the morning or tread in the bus on my toes? Will it come like a change in the weather? Will its greetings be courteous or rough? Will it alter my life altogether? Oh, tell me the truth about love. And there it was, a serendipitous find in an old bookshop, totally disarrayed, a moment of magic, and indeed what I call a browser's treasure chest.
Oh, thank you very much for sharing that, Peter, and your experience with that. And again, thank you again for hosting last week in my absence. You got some lovely comments about your
good to be here. Good to be here.
Well, from the profundity of W.H. Auden and his writing, we're going to end today's program with some light verse set to today's birthday boy, Amilcare Ponchielli, who was born on this date in 1834, best known for his opera La Gioconda, which his librettist Arrigo Boito adapted from the play by Victor Hugo. Now, you'll, of course, recognize from popular culture this little excerpt of the melody from La Gioconda. It's the Dance of the Hours. You'll recognize it from some hippos dancing in Walt Disney's Fantasia from 1940. And Alan Sherman's novelty song, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, was done in 1963. And as kids no doubt are coming back from summer camp and starting their school year, let's reminisce of what they experienced with Alan Sherman, perhaps.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. No, I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate
has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Matafata, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mada, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Matafata, kindly disregard this letter.
And that's Open Air for this week. I hope Mr. Ponchielli didn't mind Alan Sherman's co-opting of his wonderful music from La Gioconda. I certainly didn't. It was written the year I was born, 1963. I'm David Latulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. My thanks to contributor Peter Robinson, as well as to Neil Swinkles, producer of the show. If you've got a segment suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at our website as well, kalw.org. Thanks for listening.